From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, building a coalition to combat the Islamic State fighters, Ukraine accusing rebels of attacking civilians, Scots to vote on independence, plus tackling the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. About 30 countries have pledged to support Iraq in its fight against the Islamic State militants by all means necessary, including military aid. In a statement following a conference in Paris, diplomats said the aid should come in line with needs expressed by the Iraqi authorities in accordance with international law and without jeopardizing civilian security. From Paris, VOA Scott Stearns reports Iran's supreme leader has said his country will not be a part of the coalition to combat the Islamic State militants.
Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says the U.S. ambassador in Iraq asked for Iran's cooperation against Islamic State militants. In a statement on his official website, Iran's supreme leader says he rejected that request because they have dirty hands. In brief remarks to state television, Khamenei said U.S. statements on forming a coalition against Islamic State fighters are blank, hollow, and self-serving, adding on his Twitter feed that the U.S. goal here is to turn Iraq and Syria into Pakistan, where it can commit crimes whenever it wants. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says it's no secret that the United States has had discussions with Iran about the coalition against Islamic State militants in Iraq. But she says U.S. officials are not and will not coordinate militarily with Iran in that fight. In a written statement, she said the Islamic State presents a serious threat to Iran, as it does to every other state in the region. Psaki said U.S. and Iranian officials will continue talks on Iran's nuclear program in New York later this week, and there may be another opportunity on the margins in the future to discuss Iraq. Iran was not invited to talks here in Paris on the anti-Islamic State coalition. Iraqi President Fuad Masum told the Associated Press that he thinks Iran should have been invited, given the long shared border with Iraq and the humanitarian aid Iran's been providing during the crisis. In an interview with VOA last week, Secretary Kerry said the United States and Iran are acting independently against the Islamic State in Iraq, though there is some coordination to ensure that they stay out of each other's line of fire. He told reporters in Turkey that it would not be appropriate to have Iran at these talks in Paris because of Iranian military support for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Iran's state news agency says Deputy Foreign Minister Hussein Amer Abdullahian told a visiting French lawmaker that the best way to fight Islamic State militants is to help and strengthen the Iraqi and Syrian governments, which he says have been engaged in a serious struggle against terrorism. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Paris.
Also attending Monday's Paris conference was British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, who was asked about Iran's decision not to join the coalition against the Islamic State fighters.
In terms of Iran, I think it was always unlikely that Iran would become a fully fledged member of the coalition. But I think we should continue to hope that Iran will align itself broadly with the direction that the coalition is going.
Hammond said Britain will play a leading role in that international coalition, but are pivotal on being involved in airstrikes against the Islamic State positions in Iraq and Syria.
We haven't made any decision on whether or not we are going to engage in airstrikes at this stage. What we're doing here is building a coalition, assessing what different countries are willing and able to do, building that coalition as broad as possible, and agreeing common objectives across it. This meeting this morning has been a very positive step forward in that process.
Hammond also said the UK government has been in touch with the family of the second British hostage being held by the extremist, Alan Henning, who appeared in a video released by the Islamic State, which showed the killing of British aid worker David Haynes.
Our thoughts and sympathies are with the family of Mr. Haynes, and we understand that Mr. Hemming's family are going through hell at the moment. It's a terrible time for them. We are doing everything that we can to protect him, but they understand, because we've explained to them in detail, they understand the limitations of our abilities and that we are dealing with a very barbaric organization whose values are completely different from ours.
Killing of Haines added urgency to the calls for a coherent strategy against the Islamic State militants, who rake in more than $3 million a day from oil smuggling, human trafficking, theft, and extortion, all of that according to U.S. intelligence officials as well as private experts. And as the world leaders met in Paris on Monday to come up with a coalition against the fighters, there is simmering tension over differing policies on paying ransoms. The grim developments involving the beheading of David Haines and the threat to kill another Briton, Alan Henning, formed the backdrop of that Paris meeting. Henry Ridgewell reports there is uncertainty in the approach of some European nations regarding paying ransoms.
In an interview, the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, was asked to respond to claims that France does pay ransom money to terrorist organizations. Mr. Fabius denied accusations. France had paid ransoms. You seem to have information that I don't have, he said, adding that he could confirm that France does not pay ransoms. But analysts say evidence suggests otherwise. French media claimed the state paid $34 million in ransom money for the release of four French hostages kidnapped in Niger in 2010 by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Ian Bond is head of foreign policy at the Centre for European Reform.
What we saw with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb was that they did very good business by kidnapping Western tourists in places like Niger and Mali, and then collecting ransoms from governments in Europe. And that's a very negative phenomenon.
In reality, most Western countries have paid ransoms in the past, says Thomas Heckhammer of the Norwegian Defence Research Establishment in Oslo.
No country is innocent of this, but I think it's clear now that some European countries have been doing it more.
The latest Islamic State victim, Briton David Haines, was seized with an Italian colleague who was released earlier this year. It was reported that a ransom had been paid, although the Italian government did not comment. The British government says it will continue to refuse to pay ransoms. Andrew Silk is director of terrorism studies at the University of East London.
The UK's attitude on this is that if they pay a ransom, they'll simply encourage terrorist groups around the world to take British citizens hostage and put more people's lives in danger.
The United States says it also refuses to pay ransom money. Last month, James Foley, an American journalist captured by militants in Syria, was beheaded. His employers, Global Post, said Islamic State had demanded $132 million for his release. Days later, fellow American journalist Stephen Sotloff suffered the same fate. Hannah Stewart is a terror analyst at the Henry Jackson Society in London.
Ideally, we would have an international consensus, so perhaps Western liberal democracies who are the targets of this these types of hostage taking could agree to not pay ransom, but then you run into sovereignty issues and you can't tell other governments how best to protect their citizens.
A 2012 estimate by the United States Treasury suggested that terrorist organizations had collected around $120 million in ransom payments in the previous 8 years. Washington argues that while paying a ransom may save one life, it only fuels a kidnapping industry with horrific results. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Ukraine's military spokesman Monday accused separatist rebels in the east of attacking civilian areas that they control near the government-held Donetsk airport in order to make it look like the Ukrainian troops are responsible. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Kiev.
The government says its troops repelled a rebel attack on the airport over the weekend, but independent observers could not say who fired the shells that hit the civilian areas. Ukraine's military spokesman, Colonel Andriy Lysenko, laid the blame on the rebels.
У нас є свідчення від місцевих мешканців про те, що терористи.
The colonel says local residents report the separatists are firing artillery and missiles into residential areas in an effort to discredit the Ukrainian forces. He says in some cases, rebel supporters paint Ukrainian flags on missile fragments.
Я ще раз наголошую на тому, що українські військові наразі залишаються на своїх бойових позиціях.
Colonel Lysenko says Ukrainian units are holding their positions and are only firing to repel attacks. On Sunday, reports from eastern Ukraine, including one from monitors of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, described the attacks on a market and a civilian neighborhood in Donetsk that left several people dead. One woman was reported to have been killed while standing in her own front yard. Still, the two sides had their largest prisoner exchange, with 73 fighters from each side going home on Sunday. The ceasefire agreed to 10 days ago has largely prevented large-scale battles, but plans to resume peace talks next week in Belarus have not been finalized, as each side accuses the other of ceasefire violations and says it will not compromise on the key political issue. The rebels want independence. Ukraine's government says any deal might include some enhanced local powers, but the country's borders will not change. Meanwhile, Ukraine and the European Union are to ratify an association agreement on Tuesday. The former president's refusal to sign the accord led to the protests that ousted him, sparking the Russian occupation of Crimea and its support for the rebels in the east. The new president, Petro Poroshenko, signed the accord, but agreed Sunday to delay implementation until the end of next year. The decision is a concession to Russia, which threatened retaliatory trade moves that would have hurt the Ukrainian economy. Western economic sanctions against Russia helped push President Vladimir Putin to agree to the ceasefire and to abandon, at least for now, any ideas of taking control of the 350-kilometer-long strip of land between Russia and Crimea, according to Russian exile and military expert Igor Sutyagin of London's Royal United Services Institute.
That was the plan, but, you know, it's necessary to be, you know, mad enough to try to establish this corridor in the current situation, because then the fourth round of sanctions is nearly inevitable.
But Russia is continuing to support the Ukrainian rebels and is holding more military exercises. The maneuvers coincide with large-scale military drills Ukrainian forces will hold this week with troops from 15 countries, including the United States. Those exercises will be held in western Ukraine, far from the battlefront. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kyiv.
British Prime Minister David Cameron used his last visit to Scotland before a historic independence referendum later this week to implore Scots to remain part of the United Kingdom, warning on Monday that a breakaway vote would be irreversible.
So this is our message to the people of Scotland. We want you to stay. Head, heart and soul, we want you to stay. Please don't mix up the temporary and the permanent. Please don't think, I'm frustrated with politics right now, so I'll walk out the door and never come back. If you don't like me, I won't be here forever. If you don't like this government, it won't last forever. But if you leave the United Kingdom, that will be forever.
Cameron's trip was a last-ditch effort to try to persuade Scotland's many undecided voters to reject independence. Speaking to an audience packed with Conservative Party supporters in Aberdeen, Cameron stressed the permanence of the decision facing voters on Thursday.
It's my duty to be clear about the likely consequences of a yes vote. Independence would not be a trial separation. It would be a painful divorce. And as Prime Minister, I have to tell you what that would mean. It would mean we no longer share the same currency. It would mean the armed forces we've built up together over centuries being split up forever. It would mean our pension funds being sliced up at some cost. It would mean the borders we have would become international and may no longer be so easily crossed. It would mean the automatic support that you currently get from British embassies when you're travelling around the world, that would come to an end. It would mean over half of Scottish mortgages suddenly, from one day to the next, being provided by banks in a foreign country. It would mean that interest rates in Scotland are no longer set by the Bank of England with all the stability and security that promises. And it would mean for any banks that remain in Scotland, if they ever got into trouble, it would be Scottish taxpayers and Scottish taxpayers alone that would bear the costs.
Opinion polls suggesting that referendum remains too close to call. Ben Wellings, politics and international relations lecturer at Australia's Monash University, told VOA's Victor Beattie the vote there will have huge implications.
The United Kingdom doesn't have a written constitution, as most states do. On the other hand, when we talk about the constitution in Britain, we're talking about the established ways of doing things and the body of law that supports that. In terms of the political parties, it will be a blow for the Labour Party if Scotland becomes independent. The fear in the Labour Party is they'd never form a government without Scottish support in the United Kingdom ever again. Of course, if Scotland became independent, we couldn't even call it the United Kingdom. The kingdoms that are united are that of Scotland and England, and we'd have to come up with a new name for the country. Whether Scotland remains part of the European Union or has to renegotiate when it comes in remains to be seen as well, although the outgoing president of the European Commission has said no, it would have to renegotiate. So it would be a major, major change. That's clear. The question is whether that should then prevent Scots from voting for independence, whether it's just too much effort to go through that, or whether that's precisely the point to be free of some of these things that the pro-independence campaigners are hoping to set up a whole new country with a whole new set of possibilities.
Well, there's also an interesting sidebar to this story, and that is other independence-minded people, the Bosnian Serbs, the Catalans in Spain, are all watching this very closely as far as their own futures are concerned.
Absolutely. This is not just a Scottish contest. This, in particular, you've mentioned the Catalans in Spain. They are set to have a referendum on the 9th of November, which, unlike the British government in relation to Scotland, the Spanish government in Madrid has said, no, we won't recognise this. This is not, a legal referendum. Also, we might think about people in Quebec who might be watching the Scottish case, which, of course, mirrors their 1995 referendum in terms of the narrow margin between the yes and the no campaigns. But it's very much caught the eye of other what we would call stateless nations existing within larger political entities such as Canada, Spain, and even Wales in the United Kingdom as well.
Well, Ben, after 300 years of union, do you think they'll look into the vast unknown and voters will decide to stay within the union? And will this be the last of it, or will there be another push for independence?
Let's say for now that there's a very narrow margin to stay in to keep Britain together. On the other hand, in 2016, what if the Scottish National Party get back into power in a Scottish election with a pledge to have another referendum? Do we go through the whole business again? What happens if the Conservative government win the election in throughout Great Britain in 2015 with the promise to have a referendum to get Britain out of the EU? So do we then get a situation where Scots would be happy to be dragged out of the European Union by English Euroscepticism? And it might be a situation a little bit like they talk about in Canada. It's not a referendum, it's a neverendum. The issue may go on and on.
Welling says the referendum was the result of the victory of the Scottish National Party, the SNP, back in the 2011 elections for the new Scottish Parliament. He says at the time, only about one-third of voters supported independence and suggest Westminster was complacent in viewing the possibility of independence as unlikely.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
U.S. Ambassador Samantha Powers, who's at the United Nations, announced Monday that the U.N. Security Council will hold an emergency meeting on the Ebola crisis later in the week. This comes as the World Health Organization estimates 20,000 people will be infected before the outbreak ends. Speaking to reporters at the UN on Monday, Power warned that the situation on the ground in West Africa is grim and called on the international community to act collectively to stem the spread of the virus, pointing out that Liberia is the hardest hit of the Ebola-affected countries.
As you know, Liberia is one of three West African countries ravaged by the recent and growing Ebola outbreak. I won't mince words. The situation on the ground is dire and growing worse by the day. Most of you heard Special Representative Karen Landgren's account of the situation last week. The trend lines in this crisis are grave. And without immediate international action, we are facing the potential for a public health crisis that could claim lives on a scale far greater than current estimates and set the countries of West Africa back a generation. Because of the increasingly grim situation, particularly in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, the United States has requested an emergency meeting of the Security Council this Thursday, September 18th. I don't need to tell any of you how unusual Security Council debates on public health issues and public health crises are, but at this moment, it is crucial that Council members discuss the status of the epidemic, confer on a coordinated international response, and begin the process of marshaling our collective resources to stop the spread of the disease.
President Obama is set to outline his plan to boost the U.S. response to the Ebola outbreak. He'll travel today to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, in Atlanta for a briefing with health experts leading American efforts to stem the outbreak. VOA's Aru Pandey has more from the White House.
The president's visit to the CDC comes amid calls from West African leaders and international health officials for the United States to do more to assist nations that are struggling to keep up with an epidemic that the center's director, Dr. Tom Frieden, recently said is spiraling out of control. White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters in Washington Monday that because of its capabilities, the United States has a unique responsibility to step up in the midst of this international crisis.
Our doctors and scientists are some of the best in the world, and we're going to deploy their knowledge and resources to try to help some of the governments in Africa meet the needs of their people.
So far, the United States has committed $100 million towards the fight since March. Aru Pandey, VOA News, The White House.
Monday was International Day of Democracy, and the theme this year was engaging young people in democracy. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that powerfully underscores the importance of youth in building and preserving democracy. He added that democratic societies are strong societies because people are free to speak out against injustices and to discuss, debate, and work together to drive positive change. Mr. Kerry called these ideas the inspiration from the Egyptians who took Tahrir Square, to democracy activists in Burma, to the brave Ukrainians who took to the ballot box earlier this year. Here in Washington on Monday, President Obama presented the Medal of Honor to two Vietnam War soldiers for their heroism. At a ceremony at the White House, Mr. Obama gave the nation's highest military honor to retired Army Command Sergeant Major Benny Atkins and deceased Army Specialist Donald Sloat. President Obama said over the years, Vietnam veterans have not always received the respect they deserved. He said the veterans are patriots, served with valor, and made the country proud. Atkins was recognized for his actions during a combat tour in Vietnam in 1966 when he ran through enemy fire while injured to drag his fellow soldiers to safety. Sloat, killed in action in 1970 when he shielded the blast of a grenade with his body in order to save the lives of his comrades. Sloat's brother accepted the award on his behalf. Many thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. And you can always follow us on the internet at voanews.com. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers Aid Nutku and Zahrat Abu Zaid, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On September 16th, 1620, the Mayflower set sail from Plymouth, England, bound for the New World, with 102 passengers, half religious dissenters and half entrepreneurs. The ship was headed for Virginia, but landed in the Cape Cod area to the north, modern-day Massachusetts. The Pilgrims founded the first permanent European settlement in what became known as New England. On this day in 1810, Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla, a Catholic priest, launched the Mexican War of Independence by issuing a revolutionary tract calling for the end of 300 years of Spanish rule, redistribution of land, and racial equality. Today is celebrated as Mexico's Independence Day. In 1908, William C. Durant created the holding company that became the General Motors Corporation, once the largest automobile firm in the world. In 1975, Papua New Guinea became an independent nation. On this day in 1978, a strong earthquake struck the city of Tabas, Iran. About 25,000 people died in the quake. In 1987, the Montreal Protocol was signed by 46 nations to protect the Earth's ozone layer from depletion. It has since been ratified by all UN member states. In Ukraine, on this day in 2002, some 15,000 demonstrators marched in Kiev, and tens of thousands of others gathered in public squares around the country, demanding that President Leonid Kuchma resign or call new elections. In 2007, One2Go Airlines Flight 269 crashed in Thailand. 89 people were killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Movies have become an important medium for a growing number of professional and creative collaborations between the United States and China. According to the Motion Picture Association of America, China has just become the first international movie market to exceed $3 billion in box office revenue. In a commentary in Beijing's Economic Observer, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs Charles Rivkin wrote, "It's exciting to see our two countries' industries combine their creative talents to blur the lines between Hollywood and Chinese productions, with an increasing number of American studios partnering with their Chinese counterparts. As the U.S.-China film relationship deepens," Ambassador Rivkin predicts, "these partnerships will expand across important areas such as film financing, cinema exhibition, studio theme park development, and merchandising. Movies can create jobs and spur economic growth. In 2011, China's film and television industry directly contributed $15.5 billion and more than 900,000 jobs to China's economy, according to a report by the Motion Picture Association and the China Film Distributors and Exhibitors Association. Chinese companies are also becoming increasingly involved in the U.S. film industry. To facilitate this growing relationship, strong intellectual property rights are important to create prosperous open markets that generate additional opportunities for Chinese and U.S. companies. Digital piracy remains a real threat to U.S. and Chinese content creators alike," Ambassador Rivkin warned. The International Intellectual Property Association has reported that approximately 90% of pirated new releases stem from recordings made in movie theaters. Many films lose tremendous revenue when pirated versions are made available prior to the film's official opening, decreasing the number of potential moviegoers. The U.S. hopes to work closely with China over the coming years to improve the market for legitimate sales of movies, including through enhanced enforcement for pre-releases. "Can we create a new environment for doing business that allows for continued prosperity, but also respects intellectual property rights?" Ambassador Rivkin wrote. "Of course we can. By utilizing strong deterrent penalties for unauthorized recordings and collaborations between law enforcement officials, theater owners, and distribution partners, our governments can prevent many illegal recordings and further bolster our country's entertainment industries. Our potential to build ever deeper cultural ties, create more jobs, and mutually beneficial economic growth, underwritten by an atmosphere of artistic and business protection, is enormous."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.